So, how much time do you spend at the trade shows of your industry? How much time do you spend at the trade shows that your top clients frequent? Which would be more productive? Ponder those questions as we conclude Phase 5, The Publicist, with a discussion of gaining the endorsements of opinion leaders with a very simple technique. Publish their ideas.
This is the case history of Jack M., who's a financial consultant. He was an undergraduate journalism major, likes to write, written several articles in trade journals. He's got several inquiries from it, several pieces of business. But almost by accident, he discovered something that a lot of people have not figured out yet.
By accident? How's that, Tom?
He found out that actually writing articles, ghostwriting articles for certain important opinion leaders, got him more business in the long run than publishing his own articles with his own name.
That sounds like a rather indirect route, rather than writing your own articles in trade journals and getting direct business that way. Well, how has this worked out? I'm intrigued.
He returned a favor to an accountant. He wrote an article taking some of the accountant's ideas, composed it, but put the accountant's name on the article along with his picture and had it published in an important trade journal that's read by thousands of affluent business owners.
I take it he did this with the accountant's permission, of course, using the accountant's name on the article.
Oh, absolutely. He was delighted to have it published.
Was it aimed at a particular need of the industry in which the trade journal is...
Yes, it was related to the food distribution industry and had major implications given the changes in the tax law concerning depreciation and other factors which would greatly affect the bottom line of these companies.
So I take it the accountant got some new business from it since his name was on the article?
He got a significant amount of business. In fact, one of the interesting things about it was a lot of people called and said, I wonder how come my accountant never told me that. He did get many pieces of business out of it, and he was, of course, very grateful to Jack, the financial consultant. And, of course, they felt that they were in his debt.
So did they, in turn, then refer business to Jack?
Yes, an extraordinary amount. In fact, actually, the first piece of business, Mike, was a $3 million account that Jack got because of the referral made on his behalf by the accountant. And, of course, that $3 million came from a new client that, in fact, the accountant got from the article that was written on his behalf.
So has Jack gone on to write articles for other professionals, like maybe like lawyers?
Or... Yes, lawyers and estate planners, estate attorneys, and other types of people. And I might say that actually he is getting more response and ultimately more business by ghostwriting articles for key opinion leaders than if he wrote them himself. And that's the key ingredient here. So one thing that you can do is enhance the reputation, the revenue, the exposure of these key opinion leaders, and they in turn will reciprocate by giving you business. Their endorsement, for example, suggesting you're selling a business for $5 or $10 or $20 million, you go to your account and you say, I don't think my current financial advisors can handle this. Who should I deal with? The reference is made to Jack. And so what he is doing essentially now, as far as I could tell, he's not writing any more articles in trade journals that bear his name. All the articles that he is writing are ghostwritten for key opinion leaders who are accountants and attorneys.
Bart Carr is a mentor. He teaches people how to succeed, how to manage their business, how to maximize revenue, and how to maximize the value of it if they're considering selling the business. Bart Carr is a financial planner and a life insurance agent. He's also an excellent management consultant.
I met Bart several years ago, and again, I think Bart was suffering from the ones.
Having hundreds of one client of different industries. And
yes,
so forth,
and
different groups.
He said, well, I heard your music and it sounded like my song. And what he said was that he had some excellent clients, but of course they were in different industries and professions. Apparently one of his best clients is an endodontist. So he thought perhaps that this would be a segment that he could target. So he made that decision and he's done extremely well in helping these people way beyond their financial planning and life insurance needs. He actually provides them a service that enhances the productivity of their practice.
How did he go about starting that?
Well, Mike, this is interesting, and fundamental to marketing is the what we call the marketing concept. First, Bart approached several of the leaders of the Society of Endodontists in the New England area, and he asked them a very simple question. What do you need? Now, most people that approach these people say, well, either you'll buy life insurance from me, or you'll endorse me to your colleagues, or you'll have me speak about life insurance and financial planning. But he didn't ask that question. He asked them, what do you need? They replied, Bart, really what we need is someone to do seminars for us on how to enhance the productivity of a dental practice. Specifically, what we would like is if someone could come in and tell us how to maximize the value of the practice and how to sell the practice to get the maximum return out of it.
Now, does Bart Carr have the expertise to do that himself?
He does, but again, he's very modest, and what he did was, when he learned about their needs, he contacted the foremost authority in America to do a joint seminar with him on this topic. Interestingly enough, the people that were running the society also said, well, Bart, coincidentally, if you tell us how to maximize the value of the practice, and if you tell us how to sell the practice, then you'll have to talk about what to do with the proceeds that people get from selling the practice, which he agreed to. And I might point out that Bart has become the number one supplier of this type of wisdom in this industry. He's been invited to many national and regional meetings, and he's well known and well respected by these people in tremendous demand. Essentially what he is a mentor to these people. Because you cannot sell life insurance or financial planning to a group of dentists or doctors or anybody else. Unless they're making money, exactly.
And if you help them increase the productivity of the practice, perhaps help them evaluate the practice so they can sell it if they wish to.
Exactly.
Then obviously they'll have money.
Exactly. In fact, Bart has done so well with this that he's now in demand to give talks on this topic to other people that sell financial planning and life insurance. But he's made a commitment. He didn't expect to get returns tomorrow. And what he's done, very simply, is he's given a lot before he started to receive anything from this. But you can see that he is, in the mentor category, one of the very best people in the industry in terms of helping people with their
needs. That sounds intriguing. How and why was the Wolfpack established?
Well, again, we were talking to a young man, a Mr. Wolf, who, again, suffered from the ones. Several hundred clients. He is a financial consultant. No focus. And when he told me the city that he lived in, I was surprised in the sense that I knew something about it. I looked at the anatomy of wealth in the community. And interestingly enough, this is not a major city. I would say it's in the middle range in terms of size. But there are three world-class universities within 50 miles of his office. So the first thing that I said, do you have any wealthy faculty members or administrators? He has a few. And then I reflected to Mr. Wolf and I said, Mr. Wolf, do you realize that there are over 300 authors of books within 50 miles of where you operate your office? Well, he was surprised by that. Apparently he has one author, again, the expert in the ones.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, well, we need to do something with you on this basis. He said, well, what can I do? I said, well, first you have to make a commitment. You have to have the discipline to do what I'm going to tell you and establish what we could call a wolf pack. And that's why we call it the wolf pack.
What, by the way, does Mr. Wolf do? What is his core product or service?
He's a financial consultant that really specializes in getting top asset managers together with wealthy people.
And, of course, these authors are all potentially wealthy people. Authors,
yes. Now, some of the authors, and I can point this out, have had books that are textbooks that didn't go past the first edition, didn't go past the first printing. They really didn't make a lot of money. But out of that 300, there are several people there who regularly get $200,000 to $400,000 a year in terms of royalty because they have the very best-selling textbook in some basic discipline. Now, it's nice to know that, and I know some people, in fact, what I told them, I said, you can get the names of these people by typically basically going to a bookstore, asking the people at the bookstore a very simple question, do any of your faculty publish books? And of course, very defensively, they'll say, well, here's a computer printout. That's happened many times. And that's what essentially what they did for him. So he had the names of the people, the books that they publish, and all these other kinds of things.
But where did he go from there? I mean, you just don't start knocking on those doors, even though you got this nice list. And you can figure out which of the faculty members really are getting a good deal of money from these textbooks.
Absolutely.
You don't go in and say, hey, I want to be your financial consultant.
You've hit it over and over.
That's not the way to do it.
And many people in the financial consulting, real estate investing, life insurance business have been asked to leave the office of some of these faculty because, again, it's the me idea. I'm here. You've got money. I'm at the right time and so forth, the right place. And let me talk about insurance.
So what did Mr. Wolf offer besides his core service?
I said, Mr. Wolf, you've got to make a commitment. You've got to become their mentor. Two things. You've got to provide value added. You've got to give them more than investment advice or access to top asset managers. In addition to that fact, you've got to have some endorsements from some people that they would rely on and they would trust. So two things after we discussed this. In fact, one of the side notes on this, Mike, is that he was trying to network with some law firms in the community. Now, this is interesting. I mean, this guy is rather successful in his own right. He's been in the business about 10 years. But he would call these law firms. He would write to them. He'd try to make appointments. And typically what they would say is this. We do not talk to financial consultants. I mean, and that was the nicest thing they would say.
Mm-hmm.
And I said again to him, I said, well, Mr. Wolf, the problem you have is that you're not adding any value here. You know, there are 100,000 people competing with you. It's the same message. It's the dull normal, the me's. I said, I think you can blend both of these things. And this is what I proposed. Let's take a look at authors and their problems. You talk to an author, and every author tells you, I'm not being treated right by my publisher. I'm not getting enough support. They don't understand me. I'm not getting paid enough. I didn't write the right contract. Okay, that's one thing. Law firms are always looking for new clients. Now, here's what I want you to do. You go back and talk to the top law firms in the community, and some of these are really major league, and you ask a very simple question of a senior partner. Before they hang up on you, you say, excuse me, sir, I am not calling today to sell you investments. I'm wondering if there's someone in your law firm who has experience negotiating contracts with publishers. Bingo. I'm sure they do. I'm wondering, sir, if I got several hundred authors and potential authors from these three major universities in a room, if someone from your law firm could come in for an hour or two and give a talk on a very simple topic, how to negotiate your next contract with a publisher. Now, I want to tell you, Mike, as an author, I can tell you right now, people are going to show up for this. Every one of these people has a vested interest. Then, of course, what you're doing is you're giving exposure to the law firm, to these people. But besides that, you come in on the second part of the seminar and you talk about what to do with the proceeds, the upfront fee that you'll get, and the royalties by having access to the top 50, 100, 25 asset managers. In fact, several of them will show up and you can show their track record over the last 10 years on an objective basis. And I guarantee you these people will show up. So that's what he's in the process of doing right now. And it works so very, very well because what the law firm says is very simply is this person is bringing something to the table. We're able to access his mentor group. But why does it all work? Because he's a mentor. He's providing more than just a basic ABC fundamental service. Now, on the other hand, what you're saying to the law firm is this. If you want access to my network of all these faculty, and by the way, several other law firms are also interested, what I would expect from you, number one, is that you would consider me as your financial advisor. Two, I would like access to your clients who come into windfall dollars because you won lawsuits for them, they sold their property, they came into what we could call major upswing in cash flow. End of story.
You scratch my back.
To talk about include a Mr. Richard.
Go ahead, Tom. Tell us about him.
Well, Mr. Richard actually is on the other side of this mentor concept. He called me several months ago, and he said, Dr. Stanley, several of the people that I know in another industry mentioned some of the things that you have, and I'd like to be able to get them. And I said, well, what business are you in? He said, well, I run, let's call it Jamestown Galleries. I won't use the real name. But what he does is that he has in his inventory probably the largest collection of Revolutionary War documents that he sells, letters signed by famous people, things of this type. Now, he wants to target wealthy people. So he said, well, send me some of your tapes. So I sent him some of the tapes. He listened to them, and he came back, and he said, you know, my problem is I've been targeting individual people that want to buy these documents. I should start targeting clusters. I said, correct. So he was excited about it, and he thought about it. And a week later, his secretary called our offices and said, Mr. Richard is going on vacation tomorrow to Canada for a week. We would like your books here by 3 o'clock this afternoon. And I said, very simply, there's no way we can get them. You're 1,000 miles from here. I said, we can do the best we can tomorrow morning, so forth and so on. That's not going to do. She got a little tippy. So I was made aware of this, and I didn't feel real good about it. I wanted to get him the books. And I thought about it. And I said, you know, Tom, one of your major clients has, we call, an alpha branch across the street from Mr. Richard's gallery. There are 90 commando salespeople in that office. Most of them have both of your books. Why don't you call up there? So I called the branch office. I asked to speak to the sales manager that I know very well. He was not in at the time. I spoke to his assistant. And I said, Susan, I wonder if you'd get on the PA system and tell 90 of your sales commandos something very simple. Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. Mr. Richard, a multimillionaire located across the street, would be in debt to anyone that would walk across the street this morning with both copies of Stanley's books, and offer to lend the books to Mr. Richard. He'll be in your debt. He may even open an account with you. What's interesting, Mike, is that I called Mr. Richard about an hour later, and I said, Mr. Richard, Tom Stanley, and he said, you rascal. I said, what's the problem? He said, I just had 15 people storm my office with books. What's interesting about this, very simply, is that Mr. Richard opened an account with the young man that walked in there and lent two books to Mr. Richard. The young man acted as Mr. Richard's mentor. What he was saying is, here are some resources that will help increase the productivity of your business. Now, interestingly enough, no one else in the organization prior to that ever was successful in penetrating this particular business. Why? Because they came on with the same message. I've got great investment ideas for you. First, be a mentor, then talk about selling your product. But that's not the only episode for Mr. Richard.
I was going to ask, Tom, how did he go on? What lessons did he pick up from your two books and then in turn use?
He went beyond anything that I told him. This is what he did. He selected several of these affinity groups, one in particular, which was called, I believe, the Association of Association Executives, the Cluster of Clusters, the Affluent of Affluent. Now, what did he do? Did he go to them immediately and say, I want to network with you? No. He called. And he asked a very simple question. Young lady, I wonder if you can tell me what accounting firm represents your association? What law firm and what public relations firm? Why did he want to know that? Well, he called the CPA, he called the law firm, he called the public relations firm. And what did he say? I want you to help me with my accounting, with my law, with my public relations.
Oh, wait a minute, Tom. If he does this with each association, he might end up with seven lawyers or seven accountants or seven financial advisors.
Well, you know, Mike, it's kind of interesting.
That doesn't make sense.
Well, it makes sense in this regard. See how naive we all are? I heard a young man one day talk, and this is a fellow that has an income, I believe, in the seven figures. He's one of the most successful salespeople in the world, and he networks with accountants. Do you know how many accountants did his income tax last year? Seven different CPA firms. He had seven tax returns done. Now, only filed one. And he paid $400, $500, or $600 to each one of them. And people said, well, Tom, what a waste of money. Mm-hmm. Okay, seven accounting statements at the maximum of $500, just $3,500. One referral from one of these accounting firms, one of them, can be worth over $5,000, $10,000, $15,000, one client, 1 year. And that's what he does. So the issue is that by patronizing these people, the deal is, hey, I will have you as an accountant. I will use you as a lawyer. You can help me with some PR. What I expect you to do is to endorse me and refer me to the right people at the trade association or professional societies that you represent. And more people now are doing that.
So is Mr. Richard having success doing the same thing?
Absolutely. Of course he is. In fact, Mike, it's very simple, as I've always said. Is it better to try to spend a fortune on advertising, hitting individual people, or is it better to have a small booth that costs $5,000 or $6,000 or $1,000 at a meeting of 8,000 wealthy people?
Now, you once told I'll me take an anecdote about an accountant who wanted to target physicians through seminars. What theme did you suggest he employ?
Well, of course, he wanted to have a seminar about how to do accounting practices. Now, when he did this, it was very interesting. He assumed that there were going to be 300 physicians sitting in the audience. No, he had 300 office managers show up that ate his lunch and went home, and that was it. And I said, well, you know, there are some interesting things going on in the economy right now. In fact, Mike, I just published an article. It's a very interesting concept about what's the problem with physicians and the problems that they suffer. The name of the article, Why You're Not As Wealthy As You Should Be. This article suggested that out of all the high-income producing occupations in America, who has the lowest propensity to accumulate wealth?
Physicians, I take it.
Absolutely. In fact, if you look at the swing, I think the ratio is probably 6-1. In other words, high-income business owners versus physicians as being in what they call the pause or the prodigious accumulator of wealth category. Pardon that. That's an academic term. But these are people that have a high propensity to accumulate wealth. Here's the issue. When that article was published, I believe it was sent out to about 250,000 physicians. I've never gotten so many phone calls. Now, 9 out of 10 of the calls we got were from doctors that were 55, 60, 50, whatever. Most of them, no pension plan, never save any money. It's very interesting. They're making $200,000-$400,000 a year. They have nothing invested. In fact, more than one-third of the physicians in the United States save nothing. Now, 1 out of 10 would call and say, I'm in the other category. What do you mean, other category? I drive a 5-year-old car. I live in a modest house. We save our money. In fact, one fellow called me. He's worth $7 million. In fact, he wanted 2 copies of this extra. I said, why do you want them? He said, I want to give them to my son-in-laws because they have great ideas about spending money and driving expensive cars and living in expensive neighborhoods. So I told this fellow that's the accountant, I said, here's what you want to do. Get some of these people, these doctors who are frugal, who do have a budget, who do in fact have a written financial plan and budget, have them come in and talk for an hour or two to 50, 100, 300 other doctors who are suffering. In other words, what they're saying is, I will never be able to retire. I would say that most doctors in America worry about that, because what they're suggesting is, I'm 65, I don't have a pension plan. I'm 55, I don't have a pension plan. I'm spending all this money, I'm buying a bigger house, all these kinds of things. They could come in and say, there's nothing wrong with living a frugal lifestyle and being a physician. And then, of course, the accountant could come in and talk about his accounting practice, what you do with money, different sources, how to find an investment counselor, tax implications, and so forth. That seminar will sell.
So how does he go about recruiting the frugal doctors who are going to teach the other doctors?
Well, here's the thing. He already has some frugal doctors as clients. He has several clients that are physicians, and 9 out of 10 of them are people that don't save money. But that 1 in 10 group, they're the people that always say, well, how much is it going to cost me before you do my accounting services? Would it be better to go to some other accountant? They are frugal. They're driving 5-year-old cars. Those are the people, and you'll probably have to pay them to speak.
And to conclude
it would be worth
this discussion of mentoring, we now hear the story of Mr. Gregory, a rascal, says Tom Stanley, who actually recruited Tom Stanley to become a part of his, Mr. Gregory's, influence network.
Well, last month he called me and followed up with an interesting letter that he uses to network with affluent automobile dealers. He's a very creative guy. What he essentially does is he provides free seminars, books, and tapes to auto dealers in terms of helping them sell to the affluent.
So he helps them find possible prospects among the affluent, then?
Yes, he does.
But does he do it directly, or is he just...
Well, indirectly, what he will do is call these typically luxury automobile dealers and tell them what he does. In fact, he's the senior vice president at a brokerage firm. Part of his responsibility is to help his brokers find wealthy people. Part of his responsibility is actually to train some of these people. So he came up with this idea that while he's training brokers and learning about how to sell and market to the affluent, he could do the same thing in a non-competing industry and at the same time help enhance the revenue of potential prospects and clients. And that's exactly what he does. So when he contacts an auto dealer, either by phone, by letter, or in person, he will point out that his responsibilities are essentially helping his own sales force, a non-competing sales force, find affluent people, especially when they're coming into money.
So I'm the auto dealer, and I say, well, okay, Mr. Gregory, I appreciate it, but why do you want to help my sales force? Aren't you busy enough helping your own self?
Well,
your own sales force?
That's right. And what he says very clearly is this, that there are 100,000 people out there selling investment products to people, and that's all they're selling. What Mr. Gregory does is provide a free service to those people who are his investment clients. And the service is the book, Selling to the Affluent, the tape, selling to the affluent. And if they would like, he will come in and actually train their sales force on how to find affluent people, how to condition them, and how to close them in terms of buying automobiles.
Okay, I'm the auto dealer owner. What do you want from me, Mr. Gregory, for helping
me
out this way?
What he said, in fact, in the second contact that he made doing this, his question is very simple. Who are you currently dealing with? The answer comes back. What types of things are they doing for you? The answer is typical. Perhaps lack of service, not a great return, just the ABC fundamental plain vanilla investment account. Nothing spectacular. What he's saying is, how many of the people you're currently investing with have ever offered you the opportunity to enhance the production of your sales force? And the answer comes back after this pause, no one. So in other words, what he's doing is coming in and offering at least the equivalent and probably a better investment package. But in addition to that fact, he's saying, I will help you where you really need help. And the number one need of auto dealers today, clearly, is revenue enhancement, and he provides that as a free service. In the first instance where he did this, I think that Mr. Gregory did not have this perfected yet, and I think that the dealer was a little skittish about dealing with this concept, although he's still a prospect. In the very next case that he approached, within the course of 2 days, Mr. Gregory received $150,000 from an IRA account from the owner of the auto dealer, who essentially said, I have never really gotten any type of quality service from my current suppliers, not even thinking about the concept of enhancing revenue. Now, what Mr. Gregory will do next, of course, is that he has an ally, he has an advocate, he has a friend in the automobile industry, and what he will do is he will prospect other people who sell the same make of automobile in other towns that are not competing with one another. And, of course, all he has to say is, you know, Joe Dickey, he's 50 miles away from you. You remember playing golf with him at the national meeting in Palm Springs. He suggested I call you. Let me tell you what I do. And he might do this for someone 1,000 miles away. And people say, well, Tom, how can he conduct a seminar 1,000 miles away? Teleconference call. Sends him the free book, the free tape. In fact, it's rather interesting. When Mr. Gregory called me, he said, well, I don't feel comfortable sometimes doing seminars. And I said, well, you've read more of my stuff than anybody, and we've talked at length at this. So I said, if it'll make you feel better, I'll certify you. So I gave him my blessing, and I certified him. In fact, I'm putting some certificates together, and it says Mr. Gregory has been certified to teach selling and marketing to the affluent.
And you feel confident he actually could do that anyway?
He's really a scholar. He's a very bright guy, high integrity, reads a lot, and is genuinely interested in helping people, and he's going to succeed. I predict within the next year he'll have 50, maybe 100 auto dealers where he can do this.
And it might be not simply from his state, but other neighboring states?
Absolutely. He can go to any state in this country and talk to people about their language. In fact, what he can do is he can pick the top dealers from that industry, from that particular automobile manufacturing company, and he can prospect these people all day. They'll never hang up on him. They'll return the phone call because he's an advocate, he's an apostle, and he's part of their influence network.
An advocate is a person who speaks and/or writes in support of another's cause. Many high-grade networkers are ardent supporters of their clients' causes. This makes them stand out from usual service providers.
Usual service provider provides only a basic or core product. In fact, when we give people a statement to agree or disagree with in questions, the question is very simple. We state there are thousands of well-qualified CPAs, attorneys, architects, financial consultants, bankers, doctors, dentists, as well as other types of suppliers who can provide a basic service. Most affluent people will say people can provide a basic service. However, few of these suppliers have any demonstrated ability or interest in supporting the causes that are really important to me, really important to me.
Such as?
Well, let's say, for example, Mike, you own a small manufacturing company that produces snack foods, potato chips, pretzels, things like this.
The price of potatoes is going to be important to me, the price of salt, the price of other things that my suppliers give me.
That's right.
But also what my accountant does to
Well, you know, the accountant wants to tell this man how to inventory potatoes or, you know, how to depreciate slicing machines. And this is really what we would call traditional template, even bordering on dull normal. Tax forms, things of this type. A doctor calls, let's do an annual physical. How exciting.
What would an advocate do with a client like this?
The advocate would say, where does it hurt? And I'll tell you, I'm a snack food manufacturer. The states that I operate in have just proposed to reclassify snack foods as non-food items. The issue is the tax issue. You see, many states do not tax foods.
Ah.
You see?
Boy, that has a large implication.
Well, especially, Mike, if you're paying 8.5% or 7% sales tax, all of a sudden potato chips become very expensive. Now, the snack food manufacturers would say, most of these people are small business owners, they would say very simply that I'm being threatened here.
So again, what does the advocate do when he finds out these states are trying to reclassify potato chips as not a food item?
The advocate calls the owner of the snack food company and says, I want to try to help. Give me the names of the head of your trade association. I'm going to write letters to my congresspeople, senators here in the state. I'm going to write editorials in newspapers and telling people that this makes absolutely no sense. You don't find it presumptuous, do you? And I can tell you this, Mike, out of studying thousands of people in the sales arena, this is a rare event, but it really can pay dividends.
Does the advocate stop there by just writing to congressmen or just writing to the association, the trade association?
Depends on what he wants to do. What's amazing to me is the overcapacity that many professional service organizations have and other types of firms that serve the affluent. Often I can walk into an office and I can find that secretaries and assistants are perhaps taxed only 4 hours out of an 8-hour day. What's the problem with asking your clients to sign a petition on a postcard, sending this in to senators in the state saying that snack food should not be taxed? It's a food product like anything else. What's wrong with that? And what's wrong with telling your clients, I'll do the same for you if you have a problem, just let me know. You know, for example, let's say you own a dry cleaner. And you know, Mike, I always point out that dry cleaning can be a very profitable business. Top 10 most profitable small business in America. Government currently threatening to make their number one cleaning solvent classified as a carcinogenic. What would that do? It would require many of the dry cleaners to change all of their dry cleaning equipment. They're not happy about this.
Or change the way they dispose of their liquids and so forth afterward.
Exactly. But again, how many people that are selling them multi-million-dollar life insurance policies have ever said to them, I'm being threatened because my best client might cancel a policy because they can't pay for it because they have to pay for capital goods? You see, the intriguing thing about selling in America is that most people are only concerned about their own product, and they are zealots in law, insurance, investments, whatever they're selling, they're zealots, but they're not sensitive enough to ask people.
Tell us about some of the people you've met along the way who have become supreme advocates of their clients' causes. Like, how about Mr. McCore?
Mr. McCore is extraordinary. He's only been in sales for 2 months. Recently, he read an article in the newspaper, and the article very simply stated that the State Game Commission just held a hearing, and they invited certain people to the hearing to discuss whether or not coyotes should be considered game animals. You'd say, why is he reading this? What are the implications here? Well, should a coyote come under the jurisdiction of the Game Commission as a game animal, which means that it could not be hunted at certain times, it could not be trapped, it could not be indiscriminately just killed? Well, the Game Commission held a hearing, written up in the newspaper. Now, 60 environmentalists showed up at the hearing. How many ranchers?
Probably none.
No ranchers. Why not? Because they were never invited. Let me just give you some of the quotes from the newspaper article. Did ranchers feel threatened when one of the environmentalists said on record, I don't care if all the ranchers in this state go out of business, no one will miss them? Can you imagine being a cattle rancher out on the prairie somewhere in cattle land and listening to this, where coyotes are killing baby calves? They run indiscriminately all over the place. And all of a sudden, you have a group of people that are suggesting that coyotes take precedent over our cattle and our livelihood. And you've got 3 kids in college.
I imagine you're going to have a rather adverse reaction to that. What did Mr. McCore do to get on the side of the ranchers?
Mr. McCore is a man of action. He wrote a scathing 2 page, single space letter to the head of the game commission. He sent copies of the same letter to the local newspaper, the editor, and sent copies to people in who's who in ranching.
So you said Mr. McCorr has only been a salesman 2 months at this time when he decides
exactly.
to become an advocate for ranchers. What was the benefit? What became of this?
Well, here's
effort?
The thing. First of all, what did the letter say? The letter said to the game commissioner chairman, unfair, you only had environmentalists there, you completely ignored the needs of the ranchers, the people that feed our country, you ignored these people. I was in the Marine Corps. I served for 10 years. Many of the people that I trained were the sons and daughters of ranchers. These are good people. You're telling me that the coyote has precedent over cattle and cattle ranchers. That's what the letter said. Now, he sent a copy to the newspaper. He sent a copy to the head of the Cattle Ranchers Association in the state. What happened? The head of the association called him and thanked him, invited him to the ranch, offered to have him become the first non-cattle rancher member of the Cattle Ranchers Society. Three, asked him, begged him, pleaded with him to become a permanent member of the Public Relations Committee for the Cattle Ranchers, and asked that very simple question, Mr. McCorr, how can we help you? What can we do for you?
Then he can, of course, mention his core service, which was, by the way, Tom?
He's a financial consultant and apparently doing extremely well. Why? Because he wrote the letter of letters. He never asked for the business. He said, here's how I want to help you. And by the way, he helped two other affinity groups. But can you imagine the threat that you would have when you're thinking that a group of people can arbitrarily have a meeting to talk about your livelihood and your business, and only one person of all the suppliers of Bob Wire, of feed, of all these other things, only one person, Mr. McCorr, writes a letter on your behalf?
Well, and Mr. McCorr is only one of four advocates we're going to discuss, Tom, as this section, Phase 7, continues. Coming up next, Mr. Allen.
Some people say that Mr. Allen, the advocate, actually hates woodpeckers.
Why is that, Tom? Set the scene for us. What happened?
Well, here we are. Mr. Allen called me one morning, and he said, I have an interesting case scenario. He said, I'm trying to become an advocate to clients and prospects in my state. Just read an editorial published by one of the local newspapers that suggests that no timber should be harvested in our state for at least 10 years to assure that the woodpeckers in our state will be protected and have adequate habitat.
Mr. Allen disagree with this editorial position?
Well, since his best client, and again, Mr. Allen is a financial consultant, his best client is a forest farmer, Mr. Allen felt somewhat threatened by this concept.
So what did he do?
Well, he took the initiative of writing a letter back to the editor of the same newspaper, suggesting in four paragraphs that people that are forest farmers must live and breathe as well, that they have families, and that many of the people in the forest industry are not wealthy at all. For every wealthy landowner or timber grower that there might be in the industry, there are 50 to 100 other people that are making a living trucking lumber in and out, cutting lumber, preparing lumber, cutting lumber, selling lumber, and so forth. So what he was saying, in essence, is that the editorial that was published was very one-sided, that there's certainly enough room for woodpeckers in a state and for people that live off of the forest.
Was the newspaper the only entity that he sent this letter to?
No, he's very clever, Mr. Allen. He purchased a copy of a directory called Who's Who in Timber, and it listed the important players in the timber industry and their suppliers, and he sent copies of the letter that he sent to the newspaper to the heads of all the different trade associations that are involved directly or indirectly in the lumber business, and he sent copies to many of the people that are lawmakers within the state. And I might point out, when he did send the letter or the copies of letters to people that were listed in Who's Who in forest farming, he had a note accompanying the copy that suggested that he was very interested in their welfare, that he planned in the future to ask these people for their business, and that he felt it was his responsibility, since his best client was in the industry, to do what he possibly could to support them. And at the end, he had that famous statement, "I'm sure that your current financial advisor has already sent a letter of this type to the newspapers and other important people. I'm sure that your current accountant has done the same, your current attorney, your advertising agency, your veterinarian, your physician, your dentist, and so forth." Of course, this had a rather interesting effect on the popularity of Mr. Allen, and of course now, when he prospects these people, they certainly take his call and talk to him, and many of these people have done business with him. Some have even taken the initiative of calling him and inviting him for an interview at their business.
Again, a very simple technique, becoming an advocate for a group you believe in. One of the techniques, of course, that you can employ that conversation, we move to Mr. John, a young man in his mid-20s who became an advocate for causes of affluent senior citizens. Set the scene again, Tom. Where is Mr. John located? What does he do?
Well, Mr. John is located in a state that has a high concentration of retirees. He is, in quotes, a landscaper. More realistically, I would say, someone that has a lawn care service and plants shrubs and things of this type. Recently, John's grandfather discussed with him a problem. In the local newspaper, an editorial was written by someone that suggested that all people over 65 be tested every year in terms of eyesight and in terms of their driving ability. Of course, Mr. John's grandfather was not happy about this, nor were many of the people that were senior citizens, because apparently people in the, especially the 65, I believe the 75 age category, have a very good track record in terms of driving, and they felt it a threat, because they felt that if they were going to be tested every year, that this would be an imposition, that it was a threat to their rights to drive. But Mr. John was very clever in what he did. He viewed this as a threat. More than half his clientele are seniors, whether they be individuals where he will take care of their lawn and shrubs and things like this, or retirement villages, condominiums, and so forth. Now, what he did is he wrote a letter back to the newspaper protesting the comments that this person wrote, and also pointed out that the newspaper really was unfair in portraying this by itself, since the author of the original indictment of the seniors did not have any data to support his contentions and other kinds of things, hard data, not anecdotal data. And the intriguing thing about it, of course, is that Mr. John did get some phone calls and other things from people because they read it and they said, thank you very much. But what Mr. John did is he took a copy of the letter, sent it to all his current customers and said, "You're my most important client group. I really appreciate your business. And as a token of this appreciation, I hope that this letter will help you and help your causes." In addition to that fact, he sent it to many senior groups, the head of their affinity groups in the community, several retirement communities, heads of, and so forth and so on. In addition to that fact, and probably most importantly, Mr. John was clever enough to get a copy of the letter printed on nice glossy paper, and every proposal he writes to do the landscaping tasks at a retirement village or condominium or so forth, in his proposal, it will include the cost, what he will do, pictures of things he's already done. It will have certain references with phone numbers and addresses and so forth of current clients. But it will also contain a copy of the letter that in essence tells people, not only will I cut your lawn, but I appreciate your business and I respect the rights of senior citizens to drive.
Again, going beyond the core product and becoming an advocate for sales professionals. And he became an advocate for the owners of local bakeries.
Well, not only local bakeries, but in a larger sense, local businesses. Every week, Mr. Brown would pick up the local business periodical, and more than half the stories and case studies in there reflected and referred to businesses that were not locally based. And he got a little upset about this. Recently, he read one, and that was the last straw, according to Mr. Brown. He read an article about the quality of Italian bakeries in a city 1,000 miles away from where the city where he operated in. What concerned him, in his own estimation, that within his own community, there were at least 3 major bakeries that produced what he considered to be the finest Italian pastries in America. he wrote to the editor and said, look, some of your writers seem to be out of control. They seem to be so enamored with outside as opposed to inside. This is a fine community. We have wonderful people here. In other words, not only are they taking pot shots by not acknowledging the achievements of our local business people, they're going outside the community constantly and doing stories on other types of people. I think it's important to realize the quality of people we have here. And of course, he reflected on the quality of these Italian bakeries. So he did two things. Not only did he focus on people that were in the bakery business locally, but in a larger sense, what he was saying is support your local business people. Make them feel good about themselves. Now, what happened? He was invited to one of the bakeries. He can sell them anything he wants to. And he can go to any place in the town and say, I support local business.
We've just been discussing Mr. McCore becoming an advocate for ranchers, Mr. Allen for tree farmers, and Mr. John for senior citizens. And finally, Mr. Brown for bakeries and other local businesses are fine examples. But what if I'm not sure? I'm out there, and I'm interested in certain issues, but I'm not sure where to get the right information. Got any ideas for sources?
Well, I think, obviously, you want to take a look at your own customer base and see if you have any affinity for the causes of some of your customers. That's certainly one issue. On the other hand, some people have an affinity for certain types of issues because of their background. You find that many people that support ecological issues like to trout fish. Some people that are very interested in bird watching are very sensitive to the needs of birds. So it does vary. But I wanted to point out that I suggest to many people that target the affluent to read something called Shopping for a Better World, which is a book published by the Council on Economic Priorities based in New York City.
I'm a little familiar with it, Tom. I understand that they research companies and try to judge these companies on various criteria, such as?
Well, let me give you an example. Let's say, for example, that part of your job is to sell securities, and you're out there selling every type of security to every type of group. It may be better to take a look at the Shopping for a Better World book and look at the ratings that different public corporations get from this organization in terms of such things as their sensitivity towards the environment, women's advancement, minority advancement, animal rights, things of this type.
So then say if six or maybe a half dozen or a dozen companies are rated high in terms of women's advancement, for example, then you might approach a group like 9to5 and suggest that they might invest some of their securities and so forth?
Absolutely. It's a splendid idea, and you'll find many women's groups. For example, you'll find women in sales, women in marketing, sales and marketing. You'll find professional women's organizations of different types, women business owners groups and things of this type in different communities. This will be very beneficial, and what you're suggesting to these people is that you are fulfilling their need and your own need. You have a job in selling securities, and you're selling the securities of those firms that have the highest ranking according to the Council on Economic Priorities along the dimension called women's advancement. On the other hand, you might be interested in doing some work in terms of the environmental causes. The same organization rates many public companies that have publicly traded securities along the environmental dimension. And if you're interested in targeting environmental groups that are sensitive to the issues of the environment and the causes, this would be a perfect way to establish yourself on that basis. And if you want to go beyond that, Mike, what you possibly could do is even contribute some of your revenue and some of your profits back to these organizations and make that part of your proposal.
You might approach somebody like Physicians for Social Responsibility, for example. Since you tell me, Tom, that many physicians need help actually managing their money, that might be true of that group, too.
Well, I think that's an excellent idea. And they
might be interested in not only environment, but animal rights as well, being concerned about testing for cosmetics and so forth. You might suggest that they invest in the cosmetic companies that don't do animal testing anymore.
Exactly, Mike. I think you've hit it right on the head. And as I said, they rate all these companies along 10 very important dimensions. And I wanted to point out something else, just to give you an example of how much information is really out there on these topics. Many affluent people are part of the environmental marketplace in terms of not only being part of group causes, but also many of them are involved with such things as environmental firms, people that clean up the environment, environmental engineering organizations, and things of this type. Recently, again, and I pick on Gale Research Company, they just published something that I think has enormous potential for people that want to target these people. It's called the Environmental Marketplace. It lists 10,000 companies, and many of these are small, highly profitable organizations owned by families or just several individuals. 10,000 companies listed in this group. Now, if you want to blend marketing, the securities of environmentally sensitive firms with matching it with the environmental marketplace, it'd be a wonderful idea. Certainly, this gives you the image and reputation of providing something more than just a basic or core product.
Something more than just a basic or core product. That, very succinctly, is an essential part of networking.
Advisor. Tom Stanley suggests help his family and he will patronize and endorse your business.
Tom, you mentioned that your first exposure to this concept, the family advisor concept, took place when you heard Mr. Ted Collins speak about his management consulting practice. What did he have to say? What does this have to do with family advisor?
Well, Mr. Collins appeared one afternoon as a lecturer in my graduate course in industrial marketing at the university. He was an early model MBA, excellent school, fine background. Upon graduating, he started his career with a large management consulting firm. And over the years, he gravitated towards solving the management problems of highly successful, typically, private family business organizations.
So what did he have to say at this particular seminar that intrigued you about family advisor role?
Well, over the years, he started his own consulting organization, management consulting firm, and again, specializing in helping family businesses. What he found out over the years, something very interesting. Why did they select Mr. Collins? There are a lot of fine consultants out there and excellent management consulting firms in general, but he did something more. As part of his duty, he provided what we call the family advisory service, free to management consulting clients. Many times, the problem of the family business is not the business, it's the family.
What exactly do you mean by that?
Well, the reason that they would call Mr. Collins in is the typical problem, and let me quote what he said, parents who are the owners of the business, their children and grandchildren are at serious odds over the future allocation of the dollar proceeds from profits, the direction of the firm, and possible liquidation of the business.
Some children, for example, might want the business to stay intact and even continue to grow. Others might want a piece of the pie to get out with and do their own thing, that kind of thing. Is that what we're talking about?
Exactly, Mike. And one of the things that's typical of affluent households is they're a traditional family. They have children, many children. So they might have three or four or five children. Maybe one or two stay on for the business for 10 or 20 years, run the business, keep it going, and so forth. Then all of a sudden, some of the other players say, well, look, let's cut this thing up and let's get the money right now. And by the way, if you two that are running the business want to keep the business, then you pay us a few million dollars and you can keep the business.
And of course, many businesses don't have that extra assets to keep the business flowing and split it up.
That's exactly right. And one of the reasons that they would call Mr. Collins in is he would act as the expert. And if he had to, the bad guy, where he said he had fired many dozen sons and daughters of businesses. And he reoriented these people. He told them what the problems were. Otherwise, these businesses were just going to absolutely deteriorate and fall apart because of the friction that's inside the organization. So what we're suggesting here is that one of the roles that people should consider playing as marketers to wealthy people who own businesses is to provide them with some component, some part of this family advisory role. Helping them in the way that Ted helped them is just one of the things that they possibly could do.
It goes beyond just advice regarding the business itself and what the family wants to do with it?
I recently got a communique from, we'll call her Ms. Barbara. She's a financial planner, obviously a highly intelligent and gifted young woman, Phi Beta Kappa from a fine college. And she explained to me very simply that she thought that she had the design of the century in terms of a computer program to estimate the tuition requirements for children and grandchildren of wealthy households to determine how much it would cost in the year 2005, 2010, whatever it is, to go to law school, medical school, and so forth and so on. And she bragged about this, and she gave me some of the components of the letters and the themes that she would use in prospecting these people. And then I said, well, this sounds so good. Why are you calling me? What's the problem? Well, the problem was that she didn't have too many clients. In other words, she had a great product, but not too many clients. And she said, you know, I'm really calling you to get some insight on how this thing is going to work. And I said, well, Barbara, the problem you have is that you're making an assumption that everybody's as bright as you are. And I want to tell you that many, many, many affluent households have children that are not going to get accepted to the top schools in the United States. So one of the issues is you may be going out there selling a product to tell people how much it'll cost for kids to go to college 10 or 20 or 30 years from now, but the real issue is what are you doing in your role in targeting affluent to help reorient these children to get them into college?
So let's say the children of an affluent business owner do not have the grade qualifications to, say, go to Harvard or Yale or Stanford or whatever, but they can go to the local state university. What role are you advocating the family advisor take on here, Tom?
Well, I think for some people that want to take the time, and some people I know have done this, they've really become essentially guidance counselors themselves. Even though they may be selling financial services or financial planning, they've taken a study on the side to orient themselves towards different colleges, universities, actually get to meet the key actors in the play, such as educational psychologists, admissions directors, educational consultants, former and retired admissions directors of some public and private schools, things of this type. In other words, when you go to see these people, they not only tell you, here's how much it's going to cost and here's how we're going to manage this money, but I'm going to also show you I'm pretty intelligent because I know five or six people that we can call that can tell you what your odds are, what you need to do. And in one case, I think it's very interesting, here are a list of five academic boot camps to send your child for their senior year or post-high school senior year to straighten them out.
To perhaps help them get the grades up to the level to where it's needed to be to get into certain schools, to help them perhaps develop good study habits, things like that?
Exactly. In fact, what I told Barbara, I said, look, here's the thing. If you're a financial planner, if you're a security broker, you're a life underwriter, whatever, call a psychologist and say, hi, I'm Barbara. I'm a financial planner. I'm a security broker. I want to come by and talk to you. What are they going to say? I don't talk to security brokers. I have a financial plan. Try this one on. My name is Barbara. Several of my current affluent clients have children that are not big league college orientation. I'm wondering if you may be able to help reorient these children to get them to the point where they're more disciplined, whatever we can do. Now, what you're doing essentially is you are acting as a revenue enhancer for the psychologist, for the educational consultant, and so forth, and hopefully they're going to reciprocate by sending you business as well. That's how the world works. Let's try this one. Let's say that Barbara now is calling a Dr. Harris, who's an educational consultant. Hello, Dr. Harris. My name is Barbara. Several of my clients are concerned about their children's academic achievement. They fear that they will not be able to enter high-quality colleges and universities. I'm a certified financial planner. In spite of the fact that many of my clients are typically well off, they do have a need for my services. One of the specialties in providing clients with a tuition funding strategy. Of course, if their children are not college material, they won't need my planning package. That's why I'm calling you. In other words, you don't need a financial planner to tell you how much it's going to cost to send your kids to a fine college if your kids can't get into that fine college. That's really the issue.
Might be taken on by the consultant providing this family advisor advice.
Well, if they can't do it themselves, at least they can refer them to some people in their network. For example, children wish to move back home after completing their undergraduate, even graduate programs. In fact, interesting, Mike, we find that probably upwards of one-third of the male children between the age of 25 and 34 of the affluent household still live at home.
So who might the family advisor refer them to?
Well, obviously, if you have that experience yourself or know how to deal with that, you can talk to the child as well, or you can refer them to a psychologist with experience in reorienting dependent children. Other things, children or other family members with drug or alcohol dependency. And again, you can make referrals anyway and act at least as a talent scout in this capacity. Interestingly enough, another phenomenon among affluent households, grandparents wish to move back into son and daughter's home. Here's where you need a third party professional, such as a family counselor or maybe the clergy that can say, no, this is a different way of handling it. Adult children with demonstrated inability to provide for the education of their offspring. many of the children of affluent households are not terribly disciplined, or do they have a demonstrated ability to generate high incomes and maintain wealth? This may precipitate the need for certain types of trust and estate planning, where the affluent parents can bypass the first generation to the next generation. These are typical things that happen in a household of this type.
It strikes me also here, Tom, a couple of things you mentioned. For example, having problems with drug or alcohol dependency, or problems dealing with grandparents and so forth, things like this. If you've been a good networker in terms of being an advocate of good causes and have helped out good causes, you may have already developed sources within these areas that might help you out there too.
Well, that's interesting, Mike. That's perceptive on your part, yes. Because you, as someone affluent yourself, and many of the affluent people deal with affluent people, might have had the same problem or similar problems that you handled, or you could supply the names of suppliers. Or many of your other clients perhaps went through the same process, and by debriefing them, you can learn from their experience, or perhaps set up cohort groups of your own clientele that can help in this regard. In fact, that's exactly what the Ace of Aces of Networking did that we've mentioned several times, Arthur Gifford. I asked him the same type of thing. He suggested to me that from time to time his clients will approach him and say that I'm having a little trouble here. My son or daughter was not accepted at the college of our choice. What should I do? Well, he's gone through similar experiences in his own lifetime. Many of his clients have. So when he talks to clients, he says, well, what did you do, Bob? Well, we found this wonderful school where my son could spend an extra year in learning about these things. Or we sent him away for his last 2 years in high school. He went from a C-minus student to a B-plus student and so forth. Well, this all goes into the Ace of Aces network system. So when someone approaches, he says, look, it can be dealt with. There's an issue here. Let me tell you what some of my clients have done. Let me tell you what I have done. So one of the things that he does and brings to the table is the confidence to say, you had enough confidence to ask me. If I don't have the answer, I know people that have gone through similar experiences. And that's part of being a good listener. It's part of being a good networker. In fact, he even mentioned to me how this recently happened where you'd say, what is the number one need of the affluent? Well, again, he calls his clients from time to time and says, you know, essentially, where does it hurt? What are your problems? Well, one client said, my daughter Fawn accepted at two great colleges, but actually turned down at her top choice. We're concerned about it. What's the name of the school? Tells him the name. Well, what does he say? Well, I've had several experiences at that university. What did I do? He wrote a letter to the admissions director. Apparently, he's had some dealings with these people. He has supported their causes, helped them with fundraising locally.
What did he say in the letter?
I asked him the same question. Basically, I just attested to the quality of the family, to the brothers and sisters in the family, what they've accomplished. I indicated that I had been contributing and was a professional person, and I gave her a letter of reference highly recommending that they accept her. Then I asked, Mr. Gifford, how did this all come about? Client told me I had a problem. I knew he had a problem. Do you ever write letters like this? I write them all the time. Was she admitted within 2 weeks of after sending the letter? But you see, how many people out there serving wealthy people have ever taken the initiative of saying, I know you have a son and daughter nearing college. Where do they plan on going? Is there something that I can do? If I went to that school, I'll write a letter of recommendation. Or perhaps some of my clients that went there would help. But I just want to tell you, I'm interested.
Again, Mr. Gifford, the Ace of Aces. Sounds like he was actually taking on two roles there, Tom, not only being a family advisor, but also, again, an advocate for his client's cause. His client's cause, in this case, being the child that wants to go to college.
Absolutely. And as I said, most affluent people have children, often
but not
have grandchildren.
Least in this discussion of family advisors is the story of Carmine, a limousine driver in Los Angeles.
We got in the car, started driving along, and he's kind of a modest guy, and we talked about some of the problems and the riots and so forth. And what did he say? Well, he picked up a fellow the day before, and the fellow was down in the mouth. And he asked him why. He said, my two daughters go to college within the riot area. They commute 50 miles each way to go to school three times a week. Their final exam is scheduled tomorrow, and I'm not going to let them go because I'm afraid that they'll be harmed.
And would this affect the outcome of their graduation?
They would not graduate on time. These were seniors.
If they didn't
take the exam, they didn't graduate. This is what Carmine said. When I pick you up tomorrow morning at 5 a.m. to take you to LAX on an early flight, you have the girls ready. I'll drop you off at LAX. I will take them to their college classroom, and I will stand outside the door armed and I will alert the security forces on campus to make sure no harm comes to them. I'll have my car, and I'll guarantee I'll have them back safe that evening. No extra charge, just standard basic rate. Now, why is this so important in networking? When you do extraordinary things, here I am, an author and speaker, and we're discussing Carmine. And I hope hundreds of people will call this guy in California, Laguna Miguel, and ask for karma. Because why? Because he's an extraordinary person. He gave advice beyond the basic core product.
Goes the extra mile.
I think it's absolutely extraordinary. And every time I go to California, guess who I call?
Carmine of Stardust.
And the first thing I did after I got back out of the limo and got to LAX, I called my reservationist, who has 31 reservations working for her, and I said, if any of the people you place in L.A. come out here and want a name of a limo driver, here's the name and phone number.
Networking takes time. It takes time to enhance the revenue of your clients or save them money on a loan or a major purchase. It takes time to write letters to enable your clients' children to attend the schools they prefer. It takes time to build up a Rolodex of suppliers other than yourself.
The family advisor, the advocate, the publicist, the mentor, the talent scout, the purchasing agent, the loan broker, and the revenue enhancer. Tom Stanley suggests you employ not just one, but two, three, or even all eight of these methods with each of your best clients and their advisors. You've been listening to Networking with Millionaires and Their Advisors, a conversation with Dr. Thomas J. Stanley and Mike Buckey. I'm Laura Esterman. This has been a presentation of Simon & Schuster Audio. Also available from Simon & Schuster Audio, The Millionaire Next Door and The Millionaire Mind, written by Thomas J. Stanley and read by Cotter Smith.